place that a person has to start from. And the common thought that a person should start with Shabbos, Kashrus, and Taras HaMishpacha, one of those three. And we pointed out that really, there is no fixed place where a person starts. For each person, his entrance, his introduction into Yiddishkeit is a different one. And we brought down from Rav Yeruchim that Rav Yeruchim learns in the Maimah Chazal, Rotz HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Zakas Es Yisrael, L'Fichach Hirbalem Teira Mitzvos, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to give Kal Yisrael Schusim, so he gave them more and more chiyuvim to do. So Rav Yeruchim learns that how does that become a schus for Kal Yisrael? He says because it makes so many more doors open for the person to be able to enter. If there would only be a few mitzvahs in Yiddishkeit, and those doors wouldn't be the doors for me, so then I would be stuck. But if there's so many different doors, so then a person could enter through whichever door suits his neshama. And because all mitzvahs are really connected to each other, v'tayag mitzvahs ha'tluyim ba, yeah. So therefore, it will have a spillover effect, and it will encourage the person to be able to do other mitzvahs in due time. And that's more or less what we were talking about. I believe it was the last thing that we dealt with, at least from my side of it. I don't know what came up in questions afterwards. I don't recall it exactly. But that was more or less the last thing. And I wanted to add one point to that and add some other points on process and methodology. Then, after that, I wanted to outline three difficult situations and some tips on how to deal with them. The couple that are very different from each other before marriage, where one is interested and one is not, the couple after marriage, and parents and children. And deal with that a little bit, because those are some of the most difficult situations to have to deal with. And after that, I'll move on, and what I'll do is, it's not terribly intellectually stimulating, but just to give somewhat of a list of the different areas that are very worthwhile for a person to explore and to get a good knowledge of them in order to be equipped to go out there and deal with the most common questions and so on and so forth. And some of the svarim that it would be good to slowly develop a good yediyah in so that one is equipped for the most common things that come up. And then whatever time we have left, we'll just deal with this general questions on the whole, on the whole Indian per se. So let's just go through this quickly and do what we need to do here. In terms of this idea that a one mitzvah is connected to all other the mitzvahs, and because of it, once the person begins one, he'll be more prepared with time to do other mitzvahs. This particular idea in and of itself is a very important idea, okay, to communicate to a person that's in the process of growth. What do I mean by this? One of the most common things that comes up, right, I have four crises that a Bala's tshuva goes through. One is the doubt crisis, one is the hypocrisy crisis, one is the identity crisis, and then there's the capability crisis. These are four major ones that he goes through. And basically what it is he becomes interested. He starts seeing some of the wisdom of Tyre and the insight of Tyre, and he begins to doubt that he'll ever be able to, so to speak, measure up to how how broad it is and how much. So there's so much to learn, and there's so much to know, and there's so much to do, and there's so much not to do, that sometimes at the beginning of the process, and maybe sometimes longer into the process, all of a sudden the person stands back and says, this is just impossible. There's no way that I'm really going to ever get a handle on this. Okay? And the reality is that this person, what he's communicating, it's not a cop-out, and just to tell him, oh, that's the Atzas HaYetzer and don't worry about it. That's not enough. The reality is that what he's feeling is a truthful feeling, because a person needs to do a certain amount in order for him to have the springboard to be able to see within his reach other things. Let me give you an example of this. It says Lagavi Adam Arishan, in regards to Adam Arishan, that it says Vayika says to Adam Asher Yatzar, yeah, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu took Adam Arishan Vayisimeyo Bagan. So Rashi says that Lakhay Bidvarim, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him a sales pitch that he should go into Gan Eden. That's what it says in Rashi. So I remember once Rav Shneur Zichrono Livracha asked, says if anybody would have been standing outside of Gan Eden, okay, if you would be standing outside of Gan Eden, would you need anybody to give you a sales pitch to go into Gan Eden? I mean, if it's available to you and there's an invitation open to you, then you need to be persuaded. So Rav Shneur said, yeah, because as long as you're outside of Gan Eden and you really don't have a perception of what it is, it could be Gan Eden. But if you're outside, there's difficulty in considering going in. And to some degree, that's a very good mashal in terms of what the Baal HaBaalis Tshuv is going through. They see a little bit, but they don't have enough yet within what they've done to be able to really see that the thing is that it's accomplishable for them. That's something that grows with accomplishment. In other words, they look at the whole picture before they're really equipped to see that they can do it. It's only after you begin doing a certain amount that then your horizon, so to speak, expands and you can see yourself doing more. In other words, you can only see the total picture once you've grown enough to see it. When you look at it, when you're completely like outside of it or just beginning it, it's very difficult, okay, to see the whole picture and to see yourself being able to be successful with it. And therefore, one of the things that's most important to convey to a person that's going through that, and parenthetically, most Baalei Tshuva do go through that. It's a very, very normal and healthy thing to go through. The Baal HaBaalis Tshuva that doesn't feel at some point a hesitation because of this and just goes gung-ho into the whole business all at once, you have to be somewhat wary that easy come, easy go. Even though it's troublesome, you know, when the person gets scared and I can't do it and what am I getting myself into, and you would wish that the person would just take it all on, so to speak, all at once, the reality is that that's a pretty healthy to have fear, there's a certain amount of fear at the different steps. What am I doing? And can I do this whole thing? And so on and so forth. It's a normal thing. And it's better to have that kind of feeling and dealt with in a supportive way than the person just being of the kind of personality and character. No problem, I'll just turn over my whole life all at once and there's no problem with it. Those things usually don't last. But the main point that one could stress to the Baal Tshuva is, listen, you're looking, okay, where you don't have an ability to look yet because you haven't developed within yourself enough confidence, enough strength, enough success to be able to look at it. So to you to look at it now is being unfair to yourself. You don't have to worry. In other words, it's like somebody that's at the bottom of a ladder and it's 300 rungs high. And as he's taking his first steps on the ladder, he's looking, how am I going to reach the 300th rung on top? The point, you have to try to encourage them not to look, so to speak, at the whole thing. When it will be time for you to look at the 300th rung, you'll have accomplished enough to be able to look at the 300th rung. Now you're looking at something that's really not in your sphere. Don't look at it. Look in front of yourself a little bit further in front of yourself. But don't look way ahead of yourself. Because if you look way ahead of yourself, nobody's capable of looking too far ahead of themselves and not being discouraged. And it's not only in Yiddishkeit, it's in many things like that. You look too far ahead of yourself, and you don't look just a little bit of ahead of yourself, it's a discouraging business. So that's just a point, and it always comes up. And the way to tell them is, you're right, it's big, it's this, it's a lot of hard work. That would be one approach, but it doesn't usually work. It usually scares the living daylights out of them. The best thing to say is you have to look a few steps ahead of yourself, not 100 steps ahead of yourself. Okay, so he's going to ask you, well, how is it going to be different? It's still scary. So yeah, but if you take another 10, 20 steps, then you have more strength to look further ahead. That's the point. Okay, so having said this, now let's just move on to another couple of points in methodology that are interesting points. A person that's involved in Kiruv, okay, has to have his eyes and his ears open when there is movement in the Baal HaBaalis Tshuva. Right? In other words, my own feeling is that the process of a person becoming frum isn't, he comes and he knocks on your door and he says, okay, give me a new mitzvah to do today. Okay, goes home, does it, comes back a week later. Okay, give me another mitzvah. It's not like that. Okay, the process usually is a process that, for many reasons, the Baal or Baalas Tshuva likes to do on some level. Okay, with a privacy. What do I mean with a privacy? First of all, in other words, it's a very, whatever it is, and if it's meaningful, it's a very intimate kind of thing. It's a scary thing. And it also has an element in it that sometimes I'm prepared to do something, but I don't want to be caught dead doing it. Because I'm not yet ready to make the statement that I'm a person that does this and this kind of mitzvah. And therefore, it's very, very normal to find in a Baal or Baalas Tshuva that they surprise you with things that they are doing. In other words, rather than them coming and asking you, what should I do next, and I'll do exactly as you tell me, that what you usually find as a very normal and healthy thing is they pop it on you. In other words, they want to give you a little bit nachas when they feel that they've done it already a little bit, and, you know, they feel comfortable with it. Guess what? I lit Shabbos candles. Guess what? You know, I kashed my house. Guess, in other words, that's a very, very normal thing. Okay? It's a very normal thing. It's a healthy thing because it means that it's not being pumped into them from the outside and they're just doing what's being fed into them, but that they're developing a certain, like, imagination and creativity of their own. Okay? It's a very healthy thing. It shouldn't be discovered. You know, discouraged. You know, to tell them, ooh, you shouldn't do anything on your own. And I'll tell you exactly what's your next step and so on. You should never do something. No, I've seen people do that. Okay, I've seen people do that. You shouldn't do that because there's a certain amount of experimentation and doing it when nobody's looking. And it's something that's very often. I remember once walking into a Svarim store, okay, where I was out on the island right after I came back from L.A. And a couple of months into my being here, and there was a fellow there that was going to one of my classes, and he was sporting a yarmulke for the first time. He was looking in a mirror in this Svarim store to see what he looked like in a yarmulke. And I have to tell you that when I walked into the store, I noticed that he noticed me, and he threw the yarmulke back into the pile, and like he skedaddled out of that store so fast. Wasn't ready. I mean, it's very normal. It's a very normal thing. Okay, it's a very normal thing. And therefore, like, to intrude on the person, okay? You know, tell me what you're doing. Tell me what you're considering doing. And things like that. Yeah, it's not right to intrude, okay? If he comes to you and he asks you advice, or if he comes to you and it's obvious that he wants a little chizuk in doing it or a little encouragement in doing it. In other words, he's opening himself up to that you should put some input into it. So by all means. And you have to be very careful with that, that when that message comes, that you're there. Sometimes, you know, they're not even ready to say it, you know, but they, like, just glancingly mention it, and they're hoping and praying that you say something that's encouraging. And if you're just too busy to say anything to them, anything like that, they can go away crestfallen. Like, I was waiting, you know, I was waiting for this, you know, I was waiting for him to say something and to make me feel good, and he didn't say anything. So it's very, very important to know that there's a lot of privacy, okay, in that development. But whenever he or she gives you a clue that there's something going on, the clue is usually because they're opening up because they want an encouragement. If you're getting an invitation to say something, then by all means, say something, okay? Encourage them. Oh, it's a wonderful thing, and this and that, you know, that kind of a thing. I mean, it's just common sense. I'm not saying any big chidushin, but very often a healthy process comes where he or she pops things on you, okay, and is looking like for a certain amount of, you know, encouragement to continue it and so on. Now, let's talk about two more things. Two more things in methodology that are important things. Okay? Now, you might, when you go out there, you might get different opinions on this. Okay? I was once speaking to somebody, not directly, unfortunately, I really should have spoken to the person directly. A person was a chapeisik, okay? And he was an objection to this, okay?
But I subsequently asked other people, and they said that I was right. So it is possible that you'll hear different opinions on what I'm about to say. But I think that personally, I think that there are nicer routes on this. Okay, this was an episode that happened. Okay, a real episode that happened a number of years ago. Also, it was an episode that happened in L.A. A fellow calls me up. Recently married. Okay, he's a Baal Tshuva. His wife is very much moving along in the same way. They got married on the premise that they were both interested in growth. So even though he was more frum at that particular point when they got married than she was, but they were both in upward motion, as I refer to it. They were both on their way up, maybe different points on the ladder, but both on their way up. And they got married. And she had an unbelievable nisayon. What was her nisayon? Her whole life was music. Literally, that was her whole life. Her identity was tied up in it, her panasa was tied up in it. Everything was tied up in music. And she was good at it. She was part of the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra. I mean, she was real pro at it. The only trouble is that most of the performances of the LA Philharmonic are on Friday night. So at the point, I know that she started davening, she started keeping kosher. When they got married, they made a commitment to Tanis HaMishpacha. But the Shabbos was a major, major problem for her, because it basically meant goodbye Philharmonic Orchestra. All right, and as weird as it might sound to you or me, you know, like going to the Philharmonic on Friday night instead of but to a person that their whole life revolves around it, okay, that's like b'chol nafshecha b'chol maidecha. That's literally what it is for such a person. And she wasn't ready. She was absolutely not ready. Now, I've lost contact with her. I gave it over to the person that took over when I left LA. So I don't know where it's holding today. But she wasn't ready. Right? So now, the advice that I gave him, okay, now he was very concerned that this would become a point that she would be stuck on and that she would never quit her race from and so on and so forth. But she was they were both basically going with an attitude that since she's connected to this and she's not ready for it, so Shabbos is just not on the list for her. In terms of Kiyum Mitzvahs. Right? Now, the advice that I gave them was that if she's not ready at this particular point in time, okay, so she's not ready. Okay, those are not easy things to say, but she's not ready. But I said to them, there's no reason, okay, why the day of Shabbos shouldn't be kept perfectly from the beginning of the day to the end of the day. There's no reason for it. In other words, sometimes the attitude is, if I blew Friday night anyway, and I don't see my way out of not blowing Friday night, so then, like, what's the point of the rest of it? And really, she was eliminating herself from the possibility of Shabbos. Right? In my understanding of it, that's not the way to go. In my understanding of it is that if you can get her to keep the rest of the Shabbos, there's much more of a chance that a couple of months out, she'll develop a time for Shabbos. She'll know what Shabbos is based upon, what the day of Shabbos is all about. Okay? And then I think there's more hope, right, that they'll take the courageous step and go further. Now, I would never say this. You know, there's an argument the other way, that she'll create for herself a conservative or reform Shabbos. Reform Shabbos is the other way around. You go to shul Friday night and you don't go Shabbos. It's the other way around. But you know what I mean. In other words, where you make... In other words, Shabbos is 12 hours instead of 25 and things like that. There is an argument on the other side, but I think that there's ma'isa rad for it. Because l'ma'isa, it's set over v'shem v'chafetz chayim, that the Chafetz Chayim, when he used to deal with mechallelei Shabbos, storekeepers, he used to approach them, he used to encourage them to begin with, that they normally didn't take the lunch hour off in their store. He asked them to take off the lunch hour in the store on Shabbos. And then he asked them to come in at 10 instead of coming in at 6. In other words, he cut away at different points where they did, in other words, a certain amount of L'shem HaShabbos when they weren't yet prepared to do everything. And then gradually, with time, they were able to cut themselves away from the Chilul Shabbos as a whole. I mean, this is said over B'Shem B'Chavetz Chaim, I assume. I mean, I heard it from very reliable people that this was the Chavetz Chaim's Mahalach. Yeah. Let me give you another mashal. Just one moment. Let me give you another mashal of the same idea. This is a very interesting mashal. The first time that I heard it, I was very moved by this mashal. Right? And it's, besides being a very smart and intelligent way of approaching gradual process of tshuva, as opposed to all or nothing process of tshuva, it's also a tremendous statement in Avos Yisrael. During World War I, there were balabatim, lay people, together with the Chafetz Chaim, that killed themselves to establish in certain areas of Europe kosher kitchens, so that the Jews that were fighting in the First World War would be able to have kosher food. That they should have kosher food. So one day, a group of balabatim that had funded and really worked on this project came into the Chafetz Chaim, boiling angry. Why? Because they had found out that there were Yidden that ate in the kosher kitchen. There were soldiers that ate in the kosher kitchen. And when they were finished eating in the kosher kitchen, they went and they ate in the kosher kitchen. And basically, their time into the Chafetz Chaim was, for that we didn't give money, for that we didn't knock ourselves out to establish the kitchen. So the Chafetz Chaim said, you're not right. Why? He said, because if they'll eat in the kosher kitchen first, they'll eat less tarfus when they go to the non-kosher kitchen. You know, so like if you're a holy crusader, you eat tarfus, so the kosher kitchen is not for you. But if you make a cheshbon that kol kezayis for kezayis is another issa, and that if you eat kosher, so you'll eat less of issa. And down the road, eating less of issa means less timtum alev, and it means that there's more of a yechelis that this person will... You don't know. I mean, that goes under the call of limited kiruv, where you can only go up to a certain point with a person and you can't go further. And you figure, like, what can you already do for this person, and should I invest in this person? You don't know, because the limited amount that you do now, okay, could be the beginning of a major haschalah. Right? It could be the beginning of a major haschalah. So that would be a marshal, okay? That would be a marshal that there is a mahalach, okay? That there is a mahalach where there is a particular part of the mitzvah that's a meiridik in Isaiah. I'm not going to go into all of the pratim. Rav Moshe has some psukim that are not b'ksav, that are b'alpeh, with taras ha-mishpacha things, with people that are coming close to taras ha-mishpacha, with deraisis and the rabbanins in the taras ha-mishpacha. I mean, it's horrible things to have to paskin, and nobody can paskin them without a place of alongside. But there is such a mahalach. There is such a mahalach. And a lot of it, you need the places of a place, but you need also a lot of common sense. I'll give you a marshal. Just plain common sense. I was scared to paskin it for myself, so I asked the Pesach afterwards. There's a fellow that became from... It was interesting. He was an quote-unquote an atheist. He was an atheist. And then he went to an Arachim program. I mean, the Arachim program didn't make him from, but at least he knew that when the Arachim program was over, that he better start learning. Okay? His wife was already from for about 5-6 years, and he was resisting because he just didn't believe that there was... an Eivishta in the world. Right? So after the Arachim program, he became involved and so on and so forth, and after more or less a year's time, he became Shemesh Shabbos. Now, this person is a cabinet maker. Okay, he can't sit still for 10 minutes. And for him to not do anything with his hands for 25 hours, like that was his Nisayon. Okay, he was going bats with Shabbos. And books didn't help. You know, some people, they just need to do it with their hands. You know, read books, do this, go for walks. It just didn't help. Okay? But he held on to it. There were times that he called me up after Shabbos and said, you know, like, I'm at the point of, like, just quatsing. You know, like, I'm just going to blow into 10 million pieces. Like, I can't be slave of it. Then his sister, okay, was passed away in California, okay? And somebody was kind enough to tell him that he's asur b'malacha because he has to sit shiva for seven. You know, he has to sit shiva for 7 days. And even though she wasn't from and this and that, I mean, it's klar. And practically nobody would come to visit this person. Like the whole deal was difficult. So he called me up and he said, "Listen, if I don't work for 7 days straight, okay, and basically can't do anything because of this." So he told me point blank, he says, "I don't know if my Shabbos is going to survive." Right? In other words, he told me like he feels like he's at the threshold. He can't handle it. Now, let's face it. Avelis, okay, And I don't mean to minimize it, but Avelis, okay, is the Rabbana. You're going to be machmir with this person that's new in Shmiras Shabbos, and his biggest nisayon in Shmiras Shabbos is Issa Malacha, and you're going to throw at him at the Rabbanan of Avelis, okay, at the Rabbanan of Avelis, okay, and then put into Sakana this person's attitude towards Shabbos. That was the Shaila. Right? That was the Shaila. Now, in my own mind, and it was then confirmed by a Pesach afterwards, I went back to him and I said, listen, no wine, no meat, no music. In other words, Dvarim Shal Simchans, you know, in other words, everything that was related basically to Simcha, you know, I said, those are the parts of Avelis that you must keep, okay? Because it's not appropriate and it's not right and so on and so forth. But if you have to work, okay, if you have to work in order to remain, so to speak, normal, okay, and in the back of my mind I knew the Sakana, that it, from the Rabbanan about Issa Malacha by Avelis, that the Reis Kum and Chil Shabbos by Reisa, I said the Eivishta doesn't expect it of you. I didn't say the Eivishta doesn't expect it of you. I said you don't have to do it. So he right away said, "Ah, you're making an allowance for me. It's not really the right thing. I should really be keeping it." So I said, "No. The Eivishta doesn't want you to do that. The Eivishta wants you to build cabinets. 100%. In other words, the answer sometimes that he has to get is that he should know that he's not at that place." And that he should feel all right that the Eivishta understands that he's not at that place. Because if you tell him you're not at that place, and you know the Eivishta is, you know, when is the guy going to get there already? You know? That's Kegeichet Mish, because then you're putting him on a guilt trip, and that itself creates tension, and then he comes to resent it also. So it has to be Eiskemaster. And most of it is common sense. Again, even though it's common, a lot of it is common sense, I don't think anybody should feel comfortable to give such a psa without checking it with a Pesach first. But a Pesach that has a certain amount of shimush and a certain amount of understanding, okay? You're not talking about a person that has a conservative orientation, okay? You're talking about a person that has made sincere strides and efforts at being from, okay? And is up against an obstacle in his path, okay? You're not talking about a person like that the Shita doesn't hold that there should be an Issa Malacha. That's a different story. If he would have come to me and he would have said to me, listen, I don't have a problem, but I don't understand it and this and that, and therefore I don't want to keep it. Okay? In other words, I would have argued it out with him. But he wasn't saying that he had a problem like digesting the idea. He understood where the idea came from. Malacha, Hesachadas, Avela, so on. He understood where it comes from. But he said, the Mitzias, I'm not in that place now. That's there are a lot of cases like that. I mean, that Avelis with Issa Malacha is a relatively, it's not such a shverezah. When you talk about Harchakis and Isuri Terabon and Taras HaMishpach and Papa Deiraisis and things like that, that's a much more difficult, okay? That's a much, much more difficult thing to do, all right? So that's a little bit of a marshal of the idea of pieces, chalakim. Now, it is also possible, okay, I'll take a question in a minute, I just want to finish this chelik of process and methodology, and then I'll take questions. It's also possible, okay, that on some inyanim, you will never get the person the whole way. You won't. Now.
Ever.
It's possible. This goes into the call of limited effectiveness. Now let me give you a relatively, you know, nishta shvera, not a difficult one. Okay, and I gave this as a marshal to something else. I think in the first class that we had, right? I mentioned before that there are four basic crises that about Balas Tshuva goes through at some point in a healthy development: the doubt crisis, hypocrisy crisis, identity crisis, and capability crisis. These are four basic ones that every Balas Tshuva. I'm going to explain them. I'll explain them more in a few moments. Now. The identity crisis. This is something that I, so to speak, learned on the job. Okay, an identity crisis can sometimes be the hardest thing for a Baal or a Baal's tshuva to overcome. What do I mean by an identity crisis? I used to learn with a fellow that was a vice president of Litton Industries. That's a major defense corporation out on the West Coast. And he used to come every Sunday night to the Kailal
And I used to learn with him Chumash and Ashkafa and this and that and so on and so forth. He would never, ever wear a yarmulke in the street. Maybe today he does, but as of time when I left LA, didn't wear a yarmulke in the street. Right? And, you know, people that saw him in the street and knew that I learned with him, you know, they used to come over to me and say, yeah, like what is the gun says out there? Like, what is the whole thing worth? If, you know, after all of your learning, you can't get him even to put on a yarmulke. Like, so what does the whole thing mean? Okay? You'd be surprised. Okay? And people will say things like that to you. Okay? Mela, that he's keeping kosher, and he's keeping Taras HaMishpacha, and he's keeping Shabbos, and he's like, Traktish Ken Yarmulke, and Mela, you're a failure. Okay? I mean, I think it's rather apparent to you that, you know, like this, it's a little bit, you know, he's supporting two of his children in Kailul, and one of them has become a rabbi. But never mind, Echadish Kinyamaka. Okay? Now, for the life of me, for a long time, I couldn't understand, like, you know, you can keep Shabbos, and you can't put on a yarmulke. But a yarmulke is a totally different business. It's a statement to the world. Okay? And for whatever reason, how he was brought up, the environments that he was in, the professional mixing that he did with people, it's a gemenschwer for him. It was a hard thing for him. His kids won't to shantag in yarmulkes, and his ainikach will for sure carry out. He won't. Okay? I shouldn't say about any year that he won't. Right? But I didn't see it in the foreseeable future. Right? You have to know that sometimes there are gevulim and how far the person can go, and he might not be able to overcome it after 5 years, not after 10 years, not after 15 years, especially something that has to do with identity. It's important to mention over here, Derek Hager, that a lot of the problems that you might run into if you're dealing with young women in terms of issues of tznius, okay, in issues of tznius of how they go dressed and so on and so forth, it's not Bilchus tznius that they have trouble with. It's just because if most people go with this kind of a dress or with this kind of a style or this kind of a thing, and I don't go like that after being so used to it and being looked at in that way, it's identity problems. It's not the hashkafa of tznius. Sometimes it is. Sometimes a person just doesn't understand what the whole concept is about. Like, what are you trying to hide and what are you ashamed of? You do get those kinds of things. But very often the tznius issue by a woman, okay, has nothing to do with her not being able to come to understand what the hashkafa that's behind it. But it's a statement. Going with a sheitel in the street, as opposed to with your own year, is like going with a yarmulke. It's the same thing. Okay? And it's sometimes a very, very difficult thing for the person to go through. Now, one of the things that will help a person in terms of this, you know, identity crisis business is, shouldn't give up on the identity crisis things. You should show them other people that have done it, let them talk to other people that have gone through that crisis and gotten through it. Identity crisis is always much, much worse in your mind than what it really is in reality. This person is looking at me, this person is looking at me, this person is talking about me. In other words, in identity crisis, it's very similar, it says by the Meraglim, that we were like grasshoppers in their eyes. How do you know what you were like in their eyes? But that's what happens with identity crisis. You don't only think of what you look like in their eyes. In other words, you already stylize what they're saying and what they're thinking and so on. And the reality is that most, when you present yourself differently, okay, most people get a good laugh and make comments the first time, and then they move on to the next interesting object. And you're still busy thinking about what they're thinking about you and what they're looking at you and this and that, and they're not even thinking about you anymore. In other words, it's very much a product of one's own fear more than what the reality is. So it's important that when the person is really there in terms of the hashkafa of the mitzvah, and it's an identity crisis kind of thing that they're going through, you should move them in the direction of other people that have made that breakthrough in identity, and also tell them that the identity crisis is largely in their own minds. And most people can understand that. Most people will understand that. But it's part of the formula. I had I remember a case of a middle-aged woman that used to come to classes that I gave Monday nights. Every Monday night she used to come. She used to cry in class. She was an almana. She also had an unusual nisayon. Okay, she had a very, very old mother,
that in her mind she could only visit on Shabbos. Okay? And she felt, okay, that she couldn't keep Shabbos where she needed to visit her. Hey, a similar thing to what we were talking about before. I knew her for like 3-4 years, and I never saw any movement in any direction. Used to cry, wipe away her tears, go home, come back the next week, everything was the same. This went on for years. Then one Arab Rosh Hashanah, okay, I got a Rosh Hashanah card from her. Okay? A typical Rosh Hashanah card, I don't remember what it said on the Rosh Hashanah card. And her first name was B. She always was known as B da da da. And she signed the card Batya. So I turned to my wife and I said, we can chalk her up as another Balas Chuba. So my wife looks at me and she says, you don't know anything. So she signed the name back. So I said, nothing to do with it. If a person can change a name from B to Batya, I mean, this is Dr. Rambam and Hilchos Tshuva. Yeah, that's when I was talking before about the surprises that they pull on you, you know, that they macharish something for you, they didn't ask you, and they macharish, how is it? And sure enough, okay, within 6 months she was Sheva Shabbos, she found another way of taking care of her grandmother, she remarried a from person. But that's, in other words, very often, identity can either be marked the whole thing, and sometimes it's not marked the whole thing, but it's marked a part of the thing. And it takes time. Okay. Let me just cover the other two crises, the doubt crisis and the hypocrisy crisis. Now, the hypocrisy crisis, I'm not going to spend too much time on, okay? Because we really touched on it when we were talking about the mashal of partial chiyumitzis, okay? That a person at a point in time says, listen, if this is all true, I need to do it. And as I know it, I have to do it. And I'm not ready to do it, so I'm a hypocrite. Right? Very, very classical. A lady goes to a shir, is inspired about Shabbos, is inspired about Taras HaMishpacha, in reality is not yet prepared to keep Shabbos and Taras HaMishpacha, like when push comes to shove, she can't see herself keeping it, but now she's tormented because she knows that it's right, she knows the meaning of it, and she's not keeping it. So she's keeping this, that, and the other thing, but I know this, and I'm not keeping it. And I'm a hypocrite. And very often people run away for months. Months they run away because they can't deal with this seeming contradiction within themselves. And again, as I mentioned before, one of the major things to put into Balas Tshuva's head, okay, this I heard this from a Rebbe once, but in a very interesting way, is that don't measure your growth to the degree that you yourself would like to see all of these things happening. What you have to ask yourself at every point of your growth is, what is Hashem expecting of me at this point in time? Not what I'm expecting of myself. You know, people that become frum very often take certain ways that they live. If they lived in their secular life, they take it into their frumkeit when they become frum. And one of the things is superachiever, workaholics, all kinds of things like that. And when they approach the Yiddishkeit and they start doing mitzvahs, so then it has to be superachiever, it's got to be everything, so on and so forth. In other words, people don't change. Another, very often they take old patterns and they apply it to new mitzvahs and to new things. Right? One of the major orientations that you have to give a person that's in growth is not what I want to do. Of course a Baal or a Baal Teshuva is going to want to do everything. It's normal. Right? But that what I want to do doesn't become the Teveya in what my Avodas Hashem is. I always have to ask myself a much more fundamental question than what do I want to do? What would I like to do in Avodas Hashem? I have to ask myself, what is Hashem expecting of me at this point? And the point to stress is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is understanding and reasonable. Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu ba v'trunya in v'yaisa. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is reasonable. Okay? You don't have to want for yourself at any point in time more than what Hashem wants for you at that point in time. That's the strength from the Fundaibishti. You don't have to be more firm than HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants is what I want. Most people will understand that kind of hashgacha. A Rebbe once told me this, not in this context, he told it to me in another context, that when Rabbanan Shiska was a young child in Cheder, once the Rebbe in Cheder asked everybody in the Cheder, who would like to be Moshe Rabbeinu? So everybody raised their hand, okay, except Bunim. So the Rebbe was very disturbed, was very upset, and it turned to Bunim and said, what's his matter? The Bunim would say, Moshe Rabbeinu. Not Moshe Rabbeinu. Some of it was Moshe Rabbeinu. Yeah. So Bunim says, Ich verstehe nicht. The shayla is nicht was ich will sein. The shayla is was der Eibishter will, as ich soll sein. That's how Bunim answered his Rebbe. And in general, in things of Avodas Hashem, and certainly for people that are oriented in growth, they need to understand that the measurement of growth is not what they would like to do at a point in time. But yes, what they would like to do is a major part of the motivation and so on and so forth. But when they're trying to measure themselves up, am I accomplishing, am I not accomplishing, and so on and so forth, what they need to know is, am I doing what the Eibishter expects of me at this point in time? It's a very, very important chinuch to give. It's a chinuch for us. It's an important chinuch for us. But that usually solves the hypocrisy problem. Okay. Now, let's just do the doubt crisis for a couple of moments, and then I'll take questions, and then we'll do the unique settings. Doubt crisis is Yetzirah L'Mafreya. That's what the doubt crisis is. What do I mean, Yetzirah L'Mafreya? What I mean is that the Yetzirah works on a person. I'm just giving it as a marshal. The Yetzirah works on a person that he shouldn't do something good. And what happens if the Yetzirah never fails and the person actually goes ahead and does it? So the Yetzirah tries to make him a Tayyala Rishonis. He tries to get him, in retrospect, to regret it. Another similar to the Vart that some of Farshim say, that the Satan came to Sarah and told her about the Akedah, and she died, and the whole Kavan of the Satan was so that Avram Avinu would have Karata on the Akedah because he lost his wife because of it. In other words, if I couldn't convince Avram to fail in the Akedah before he went through with the Akedah, I'll try to be Oikaret La'afikach. Okay? I'll try to be Oikaret La'afikach. Now, what is the concept in the Yetzirah coming to a person after he's ready made an accomplishment and tries to uproot it afterwards? Okay, what's the mahalach? The mahalach in it is that it's developing a deeper commitment to the same thing. Right? In other words, let's take the case of a Baal Tshuva. I'll explain it as clearly as I can. A Baal Tshuva is struggling. Should I keep Shabbos? Shouldn't I keep Shabbos? Going back and forth. So, and then it comes up with enough information, sees a Shabbos once, does this, does that, okay, I'm going to keep Shabbos. Okay? And has one or two Shabbos under her belt. Her belt. Yeah. Then all of a sudden she wakes up. Now, that doubt crisis can come out of the clear blue. Just have a suffix about something that I've already accomplished for the sake of it being a suffix. Okay? That's Yetzirah L'Mafreya. I mean, not with a malicious intent. But what does the person have to do now that I went the first step and I did it? Now I have to take the second step and be strong enough to keep it. It's like miyala b'harashem u'miyakum. It's a different madrega. Well, the Baal or Baal's Tshuva, this happens so many times. The Baal and Baal's Tshuva comes to me and says, listen, I made a decision to keep Shabbos. I kept three Shabbos straight. Pathetic how sometimes they tell you out of the story and said, and then I got a job offer. Three times what I'm getting paid now, it doesn't happen anymore today. Three times, but I got to work on Shabbos. She says, so what's your problem? You can make a commitment to Shabbos, it's out of the question. So they say to themselves, yeah, in all probability I won't take the job, but I want to know one thing. It's so hard for me to keep Shabbos. Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu throw this at me after I decided to keep Shabbos? So I told him, it's very simple, because it would have thrown it at you before. Okay, it wouldn't have had any productive results because you weren't ready for that level of the deciding. But now that he sees that you've kept a couple of Shabbos, now he's taking you to the next level in the depth of your connection to it. First, he gives you Shabbos without a heavy price tag attached to it, and then he says, oh, you're in it already, now you're equipped to pay a price for it also. The higher the price that a person pays for it, the deeper connected he becomes to it. Right? And in general, the whole doubt crisis, if it comes from a logical place or from an illogical place, is that the person should, so to speak, chazer iver, that he should go over again what his commitment is and bring it to a deeper level than it was l'chatchila. It's totally normal. You don't have to think that the person is a flake. So long as the person moved into it originally in a healthy way, don't be nervous about the person that comes, you know, wolves that wakes up, you know, you finally put your cup with something, comes back and says, you know, I'm not really sure about this whole thing. Don't cut the stylus. It's a very normal
part of the power system. They need encouragement. They need to understand why it's going on, what could be accomplished by it's going on. Okay, but you don't have to become discouraged by it and say, well, this person is obviously like a pendulum on a grandfather clock and he's not material for anything. It's not like that. It's totally normal. It's a completely normal thing that a person goes through at a certain stage. It's very normal. Yeah, okay, some questions.
In the case of the essential harmonics,
yeah.
What do people feel you should accept it?
Well, one particular person thought that I was mad. And that I had no right to tell her that she can keep part of Shabbos and not keep another part of Shabbos.
What do they want?
This person presented. I didn't speak to the person directly because I felt if I would speak to the person directly, so I might be tied to the person. And I really didn't think that this particular person understood the whole picture of it. And I mean, again, I didn't follow Zecha myself. I went and I asked somebody that I had more confidence. That he was a reliable person, and that at the same time he understood the parasha. But he felt that there's a danger that will be the Shabbos for this person forever and ever. That was his fear. And to present a partial Shabbos to a person, yeah. Okay? No, you have to hold out, so to speak, that the person needs to know that they have to make an either-or decision. That was what this person's opinion was. In other words, if you tell them you can do it this way and it's all right, there's always a fear that they'll remain on that kind of framework of Shabbos. And I can't agree with it. You're asking me so to speak, play devil's advocate and protect and, you know, defend that position. To me, it's like the Fishlatan says, well, it just doesn't, you know, it just doesn't, you know.
The whole purity field is, it has to, it is. The double posture, the person, the first time they
hear. I'm not going to tell you who the Pisces was because you'll flip when you find out. But in any case, okay. Yeah.
You said it is limited purity. Now, is that where does it end up? I mean, what makes it something else first? So, I mean, I don't think
it's not the end of the world.
Right. So, but in terms of like the big one, Shabbos, it's actually never to Shabbos. So that's major or never to Shabbos problem. So, I mean, do we let that limited purity, or do we need to prevent it?
I think that what you need to do in those cases, okay, I think that what you need to do in those cases is that. You need to keep doors open. In other words, the person always should be encouraged to keep a connection to learning. The doors should always be left open that the person, you know, can always come in. You know, in other words, don't say, okay, this is how much you can do. You have it made, so to speak. You know, Bali Chuvas become very self-conscious of the fact that if they don't live up to the teacher's expectation, that after everything that the teacher has done for them, they're going to disappoint the teacher. It's a very, very normal fear that they have. Maybe you must probably have that experience with teenagers, even maybe more so than even adults in certain situations. What? Yeah, no, but they have, you know, but they fear that after everything that the other person did for them, they failed the expectation of the person. And I think that what you need to do, okay, in those cases, that you never should make the person feel that much of, so to speak, in the sense of a failure, okay, that you know, that they don't feel comfortable to still have a connection to you and still have a kindness to you and things of that nature. Because again, you never, never know, okay. The Nesivus in Kehela says, Shlach lachmacha apnei amayim, ki berei vayamim timtzenu, which Mepharshim say all kinds of pshatim, what does it mean, throw your bread on the water, and you never know when you'll find it. You know what the Nesivus says, Shlach lachmacha apnei amayim? He says, in other words, put energy into people. Okay, obviously there's priorities, okay, but put energy into people even though you can't imagine a way that the investment will ever come back. To the energy that was put in. Why? Keep it right by young Tim Sanum. Because when you're dealing with a yid, you never, never know, okay, when it's going to happen after me and how it will happen after me. You don't know. Now, that's not to say that you spend all your time with this person that's basically, for the time being, a limited investment, so to speak, and you divert attention from younger kaychas or healthy kaychas. That are really with time prepared to go the full way. I'm not saying that. But the notion that, okay, this person is not a Shomer Shabbos, so he's going to be Chayav Karis anyway, so what am I bothering with him? Things like that. That's not right.
So you could let them mistake why by the Shabbos.
Yeah, you can. You know what you can do is you have to, like, weigh this out and measure this out, you know, at different points in time of making another attempt. Okay? But the attempt has to come from a reasonable place. The person has more information than he had before. He's grown in certain ways, so there's a reason to believe that maybe I'll have a chance at him now that I didn't have before. In other words, the glock to become a nudge, like periodically I call you up once in 3 months and I ask you, no, what's about Shabbos? Okay? That doesn't usually work. Okay? But it's basically to retain connections, keep doors open, make the person feel that he's not an upgefecht. I mean, those are all important points, okay, that he will ultimately come to, you know, he could very well come to consider it down the line. And you have to keep something else in mind also. I just had a horrendous, I didn't have, I had a horrendous case of a couple, okay, that are slugging it out. She doesn't want to be firm at all, and he wants to be super firm, and so on and so forth, okay? But he, okay, by a certain amount of personal example, has made enough of an impression on her. He will sit and eat kosher, and she will put cheese gratings on her meatballs, okay? But he has made enough impression upon her that she's willing now to send her kids to a proper yeshiva, okay? So, go no. Okay, in other words, for her, she doesn't want this. She's the Chabal Taivinik, she's this, she's that. However you want to be magdered. But you never know where it can happen up to me. And she's prepared to send her kid to a yeshiva. Okay? So you don't know. So what are you going to say? She's still sprinkling her meatballs with cheese gratings. I'm sorry if I'm turning anybody's stomach. But in other words, that's a perfect motion. You never know. And it's not to condone the bus of a chalav. I'm not saying to condone it, but you never know. Rumi can unrear it. Yeah.
Two questions. One about that gentleman that was mentioning about the carpenter who came to you, cabinet maker.
If I call him a carpenter, he gets insulted.
Sorry,
he's a cabinet maker.
Maybe he'll hear the tape.
No, I don't think so.
He came to the Rav and he said, I have this problem. It seemed, granted, we can't be mind readers, but the fact that I don't know how much trust and honesty an individual will give to a person who wants to mekare them, a person who's in touch with them. Often people are embarrassed about saying things, and they won't do it anyhow. They won't do it to ask you, and they'll still feel guilty about it. But you know them enough that they won't say it to you, but you know what they're doing and thinking, and you don't want to say it then also without them saying it to you. Like, In other words, where's that line?
I think that the line, okay, is that if you have reasonable feeling that if you approach it the right way, that in time they'll be accountable what you have to say, that even if they don't bring it up to you, you should bring it up to them. Okay? In other words, to the extent that you know, you have a sense of the person, that the person could be makabalit, if not today, but im hasman, that you bring it up. But you have to bring it up very carefully. I have such a case right now, okay, in Edison, where the person that's made major strides in all the areas, okay, but he comes from a family that's extremely close, okay, and they must spend Saturday together. Now, his parents are not from. So the way it works is 2 Saturdays a month, his parents come to him. So in Zeinhuis is Erbalabas, yeah. But there's 2 Saturdays that he goes there. Okay. Now I found out, okay. I didn't call the FBI, but I found out, okay, that when he goes there, he eats the food there, and the food's not kosher. In his own house, he's blocked. Okay. But when he goes there, in other words, he can't imagine himself coming with his own food and things like that. Now he came to me. Thursday. He came to me Tuesday, and he came to me with a shayla. Right? Now, Bishas Maisa, when he came to me with the shayla, I didn't know this. He came to me with a shayla. Does he have to discourage his parents from coming to him on Shabbos because they drive to come to him? Okay. And I answered him what I wanted to, what I answered him. Okay. You almost probably asked me what I answered him. But that's the next question. But in any case, and then afterwards, like a half hour after he left, and I answered him what I answered him, I found out that when he goes there, he eats their food. That's a Panishka effect. Okay. So I had a deal by myself. What should I do? In other words, he clearly was picking and choosing what he was prepared to ask and what he wasn't prepared to. It's Mamashua Kex. He's picking and choosing what he will and what he won't ask. Now, but I had enough of a talk with him when he presented this Shaila to have a feeling that it's a big Nisayan for him, okay? But that he's enough on the track of MS that if it's told to him in a nice way and in a sensitive way and things like that, even if he won't do it miyad, but it'll be the next thing that he's going to strive to try to accomplish. So then, the person that learns with him, I don't learn with him. Somebody in the yeshiva learns with him. So the person came over to me. He's the one that tipped me off. So the person came, should I tell him that the mashgiach wants to speak to him next week? So I said, absolutely not. So he asked me, so how are you going to have this talk with him? So I said, I'm going to bump into him in the hall. And in other words, when you're finished learning with him, Wednesday, I have to prepare my shmooze. I walk up and down the hall. I'll take a friendly chat with him. And one thing will lead to the other, unfortunately. And I'll get on to the subject with him. But don't get him scared ahead of time. And don't get him apprehensive. What does he want? And what is he going to demand of me? So much of it is just if you care enough. Okay, so then hopefully the button called common sense gets pushed. That's all it's doing. Most of it's just common sense.
So basically you told him that eventually when he's ready for you...
I didn't do it yet. That's this week. That's next week's job.
But I would tell him. That when he feels ready, he should try and strive.
I would tell him that he shouldn't be afraid of it. I'll tell him different things, and I'll send him, in all probability, to people that went through the same thing, of having to go to parents and so on and so forth. And, when you make that break and you bring your own stuff or things like that, or you at least ask them to respect your standards a little bit more, things like that.
Just one other question about we spoke about having expectations not more than what a Kishbarga wants from you. And an individual would say, I'm a Tzelem Elohim, so what I really want, how can I be able to be the difference between what I want, really what a Kodesh Baruch Hu wants. You can tell me what God wants from me. I mean, you can say it's reasonable, so it's all common sense. But how can you differentiate?
It's nobody can do it for themselves, okay, without an objective opinion of somebody that has a certain amount of experience and is somewhat of a guide or a Rebbe to them. You can't do it for yourself. I can't do it for myself. Okay, and the Baal Tshuva can't do it for himself. I very often tell Baal Tshuva that, in other words, I'm telling you that HaKadosh Baruch absolutely does not expect this of you. I tell them things like that, and I tell them that I also, okay, when I have questions of what's expected of me and what's right and what's not right, that I also will go to somebody and ask because I won't trust myself or I can't be objective enough. It's fair as a fish to tell them that. In other words, that the same process that they're going through is one that I expose myself to. That the answer to that question is that no person can do it for himself. That's what a person needs a rabbi for. No person can do it for himself. I don't think.
But they can say that you.
But
they can say because you're saying to them, here's what a Kodesh Baruch wants from you, and that takes a lot on one's shoulders.
Okay, I mean, you talk about it based upon experience, based upon, in other words, you have to, sort of speak back it up from, at a certain point, there is a certain confidence that builds itself between the two people, okay? And you're not talking about a person that's going in the opposite direction, that's not interesting. You're talking about a person that has his spiritual engines revved up and he wants to do more than you're prepared for him to do at this point in time. So, in other words, so he is coming before you as a person that's spiritually motivated. You're saying to him, basically, I don't disagree with you. I'm saying l'shitascha is a way of doing it. Okay? I very often tell the people the mashal of the Hagbala around Har Sinai. In other words, You know, every yid wanted to climb to the top of the mountain and have bigger hasagas. And a part of Kabbalah Satayra was Hagbalah. In other words, different mishalim. In other words, that everything is in process and things like that. Okay, let's deal. Yeah?
In the case where someone did drive a car on Shabbos to shul, and because it was very far from the shul, will we allow him to go on Shabbos by car?
A person that will ask such a question, okay, if you have any way of getting through to that person, what I feel that you need to tell such a person is that you're coming to shul because you want to, okay, spiritually accomplish something. Davening, minyan, this, that, the other thing. You have to explain to them that even though they don't yet see, okay, how it's happening, but that there's a profit-loss equation that's involved in it, and the loss is greater than the profit. Now, sometimes they don't have the ability to understand that. That's sometimes, most of the times. They don't have the ability to understand that. But I think that somebody in Kiruv does have, provided that he has some kesher to the person and some respect, some confidence, you know, from the person, I think he has a responsibility to tell him, listen, you don't necessarily yet have a way of measuring the profit loss that's involved in this transaction, but I'm telling you that the loss is greater than the profit. Now, they could turn around and say, I'm sorry, Rabbi, but I need this social contact, I need this community business, I need to hear a cousin, I need it for my family. I don't think that you should put on a pair of boxing gloves and you know, slug it out. You've stated that it's profit loss. And when the person will be more advanced, they'll most probably come back to it and they'll come to see it themselves. I've seen it many times. That they stubbornly say, like, I can't accept that, Rabbi, and I'm going to continue going, and so on and so forth. But somewhere down the line, as they do grow in other areas, then they come back to what you've told them, and they, you know, I'm sure you've read the story of people that have resolved the problem by simulating a minion in the house and doing all kinds of things. You know, of course, it's Irish. You can't have a minion in the house with your wife and your kids, but. It moves, but I think that in other words, when a person is coming from a place of believing that he's doing something that's spiritually positive, okay, and he's, in other words, a person that's not motivated in that way, okay, I'm not spiritually motivated, what's the point of starting to talk to him about the fact that he's going to shul and he shouldn't be going to shul? But if a person, in other words, he claims to be in your camp, he's l'shitaska already, so you're telling him l'shitaska, you're not accomplishing what you think that you're accomplishing. I think
Someone's
frying.
What?
Totally frying. What? That you should discourage him from coming to the show? You're getting me to answer the other question that they asked me for. What would you do otherwise on a Saturday morning?
What would you do otherwise? Oh, that's the question whether she was right. I don't know. I can't answer that.
There is a psak. I misplaced the psak, but there's a psak from Rebbe Yashin. I mean, there's things that you can't pass in yourself. There's a psak from Rebbe Yashin from the Shlom Zalman in Eretz Yisrael that says that it's a very broad psak. I have to find it. I have to fix that. Okay, that you're absolutely not mechayiv. Okay, to discourage or to be menayiv from them information in terms of coming, you know, to your house Friday night and things like that. In other words, befrat if you know. Okay, that. In other words, they are mechalalei Shabbos. If they're not going to drive to you, they'll drive to a movie, or they'll do this or they'll do that. So, you're not mechayiv to. You are from time to time mechuyev to tell them that, you know, that you're welcome to stay for the whole Shabbos, and the real way to do it is, you know, sometimes you could do that, sometimes you can't do that.
But you're not mechuyev to do what?
You're not mechuyev to discourage them or to be
meneya. I won't have them, but the information, the idea they have to have.
Yeah, there's no.
You have to know that they're not supposed to.
What?
You have to know that they're not.
No.
the idea of driving, that's what
throw at them. I don't think it's the first thing to throw at them. In other words, if they're coming for the first time to a beginner's minion, I don't think the first thing, I want you to know this is wonderful what you're doing, but it's all wrong. Okay? I don't think that that's the first thing to tell them. Okay? Okay? In other words, when they get more advanced and they get more involved in it and so on and so forth.
They heard okay. it. The mice, they heard it. The mice, they know that Orthodox Jews don't drive the
Shabbos.
Yeah. If he tells her, he's encouraging her. Okay, and she says he's encouraging her.
She has an interest already in the beginner's meaning. You didn't.
Well, encouraging her to drive, that's what I mean. Isn't he in a sense encouraging her
so
to
that's drive? The sacrament of Eliashiv. I have to find it. I mean, you don't have to trust me until you see it exactly. But that's the psak. He doesn't even say it about going to shul and davening. He says it about coming over to spend the suda Friday night.
You could
invite
someone.
Really, Yashiv in the mitzvah says that you can.
And invite
yes. But that there's you know, obviously that's one of the hardest things in Kiruv. You have to know the point when the person could get the information, and even if they're not mamish ready to deal with the information, but at least it falls already into the ballpark of something to strive to. That doesn't mean that la'olam v'ed it becomes a federal secret. Okay? In other words, as the person grows, okay, and as the person advances, there will come a point in time that you'll have to confront them. But when you feel that they're more ready to deal with the shayla yeah the nish. Okay?
I heard Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg answer this shayla last week.
Yeah.
He said you can invite them for Friday night. As long as you tell them that you have arrangements for them to stay the whole Shabbos, whether they take you up or not, it's their problem.
Rashi doesn't even write that in the thing.
I don't know that question, but Pam was asked this question by one of the Tzemach connections on these lineups. After I don't know the exact question, but he seemed to say something that you have to imagine that you already have a guest called Shabbos, and by them coming. They're insulting the guests that you have already. I mean, I don't have the exact question. It's not lemaisa. I don't know.
There could be different shitas in this, and on the other hand, it could be taught. You know, one psak could apply to one situation, another psak could apply to a different situation.
Is it different if someone really is not interested in learning for themselves, but they want to spend this? They would want to visit you Friday night.
I mean, obviously, if you're setting up. Excuse me, just one second. My head's like a sieve. In a minute, I'm going to forget it. But obviously, if you're setting up a Kiruv operation and things like that, and you have a choice of making a beginner's minion on a Shabbos or making a beginner's minion a mashal on a Sunday morning or things like that, I mean, you have to be a Baal Seichel. I mean, you don't dafke have to create it in a situation that it's geirim that kind of. You know what I'm saying? That it's geirim that kind of a situation. You know, no, I'm just saying. Yeah, I mentioned Avzayin Klug. And then there's another exception also. Let's say you're running a Shabbaton. Yeah, you're running a Shabbaton, okay? And you're trying to create a certain atmosphere, okay? And a person says, you know, I want to come to the Shabbaton, but I'm going to walk in with my suitcases and everything into the main lobby and check in 3 hours into the Shabbaton with everybody around and blah, 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 okay? There's a place to tell the person, okay, we're trying to create a certain atmosphere and this and that. That's a different story. You're trying to create a certain atmosphere. There's a certain decorum to the Shabbos and so on and so forth. In other words, not that you're putting it on them, but that the way that they're behaving in this particular situation is staring the same thing. If you have a family, you have kids, and the guy drives up and the kids say, oh, our Shabbos guest is here. You know, so it's not wrong. Okay, it's not wrong to tell the person, listen, for the sake of the family and for the sake of the decorum of the home, park a block away, don't park in front of the house. And if they say they can't do that or they don't want to do that, then, you know, there are certain gulim, there are certain boundaries. This is not like a total free-for-all over there.
Well, you have to answer it, though, in general. I mean, what's the story talking to?
Yeah, but I have to see it in, you know, I have to find the darn piece of paper. But it was very, very explicit, and it didn't have those, you know, this time, that time attached to it. Let's go a little bit further, okay? Let's go a little bit further. And Hagam, that we said everything that we said over here, okay? If you, when you get involved in it, you have these shyness, ask. In other words, don't come as a chan, you know, on a class that you had in Torah Vedas on January 23rd, you know, I heard a psak halacha there. If I cared, once you're involved in it and you're dealing with it, you know, you never know, every case is its own. in some way different. You never know. But not fragging and finished. All right, let's deal with the couple situation. One from, one not from. Okay, that's even worse than the parents and children. Okay, in the parent children business, where a kid becomes from on his parents. Okay, you have to understand. Okay, that most often a major part of the difficulty that comes up is not religious, but psychological. Okay, and very often. Okay, is the fault of the child. Now that's a horrible thing to say about a Baal Tshuva, but let me explain it. Let me explain a little bit what the dynamics are. What parents suffer from, if they say it or not, okay, is that when a child goes off and develops a new derech, and I can't eat by you, and I can't this by you, and I can't that by you, what parents go through, forget about philosophy, forget about this, that, what they go through is that my way isn't good, I'm not respected, I've been rejected, I won't be loved anymore. Yeah, even parents go through those kinds of feelings. It's not only kids. Parents go through identical feelings. If my kid can't eat by me, in my mind, in a mother's mind, that means, okay, that our relationship is over. I says, I'm not, I'm finished. Okay? I'm being rejected, I'm not good enough, I'm not this, and I'm not that. Okay? And very often, that the kid, very often, by what he says and what he doesn't say, confirms it. Okay? In other words, what I'm basically saying is that a child needs to understand. Okay? These children are not very often, they're not always children. They're teenagers and adults and so on. They need to understand what the parent is going through and try to compensate for that. In other words, statements about how, LaMarshall, I could only have gotten to the place that I've gotten based upon what you've given to us. And we'll go into that, okay? Or that this is meaningful for me, but that it doesn't mean that I reject you as parents, or that I don't love you, or I don't appreciate how you've raised me, and so on and so forth. What I'm saying is that it's really a psychological issue. It's primarily an emotional issue. In other words, they feel a loss on some level, okay, and a rejection on some level. And it's hard to give exact instructions how a parent shouldn't feel rejected by a child, but a person has to go through the efforts of making sure that the parent doesn't go through that to whatever extent that that's possible. Right? And instead of trying to become a crusader and changing the parents and so on and so forth, just being a silent model of how happy I am in this newfound thing that I found. Okay? As opposed to saying, I've got the right way, you're all dead wrong, and things like that. And those things are never productive. You know, a Balas Tshuva comes to me and says to me, listen, you know, I have a question. Should I go away every single Shabbos so that I have a nice Shabbos environment? Or should I, so to speak, you know, stake it out with my own paper plates, with my own black, my own thing, and stay home? Difficult question. Difficult question. What I usually ask them is, what's their relationship with their parents? How are their parents doing on this whole thing that they became from? You know, are they really going through a major crisis because of it? Do they feel that Judaism and Orthodoxy alienates families, and that I've lost my child because my child doesn't spend any time with me anymore? If it's that kind of a situation, I tell them that at least, let's say once in the month's time or something like that, it's not as comfortable, it's not the most lechatchila d'kashamis, it's not this, it's not that, but you got to make an effort to spend time. Now sometimes, parenthetically, it doesn't have to be Shabbos. Sometimes a family hangs out, excuse the expression, Sunday, okay? Oh, but you have other things to do Sunday. But it's not necessarily so. You have to make a special effort. So spend time with them when it's not an infringement on your Shabbos. In other words, you have to go out of your way to try to compensate for what they perceive as the loss. Now, I'll come back to something that I said before that didn't sound like it made any sense. very often, okay, very often, children, okay, the notion that when a child becomes a Bala or Bala's Tshuva, like they're Kikatan Chanoi Lakdam, like, and they don't have their genes and the characteristics of their parents. No, it's like called Chanoilad. You're not my father, you're not my mother, if not in a literal biological sense, but in a spiritual sense. That's a lot of rubbish, okay? When a person becomes frum, okay, after everything is said and done, they're a product of their upbringing, okay? And their character and their personality, for better or for worse, was developed and was cultivated by how they were raised, okay? Now, unless you're in a real bad family situation, okay, there are a lot of things that you've received from your family, non-from family, okay, that actually have helped you to get to the place that you've gotten to. Let me give you an example. Let's say you grew up in a family where you were very loved, and you were always supported, and you were always made to feel confident about the things that you did. That must probably played a major role in your becoming frum. Not that your father sat you down and taught you Yud Gimel Ikra, he doesn't believe in them, but the fact that you grew up in an environment that in psychologically, emotionally, personality-wise, you were basically brought up in a healthy way, that prepared you to take the next step. Right? And that's also something that's important to tell parents. That I'm not saying by becoming frum that the only thing in my life that has any value is the day that I became frum. It's not true. It's not true. The way that a person was raised and the things that mold his character that are healthy things are now the things that are going to help him be frum. Right? So to tell a parent that nothing ever good happened to me till the day that I became frum is an unfair statement. And it's not a true statement. Okay? And it destroys a relationship that doesn't need to be destroyed. Now, sometimes parents are shveri bali dvarim. I mean, I'm not stupid. So, you know, sometimes parents are, you know, like akshanim that ain't kamaisim. You know, and no matter what you're going to tell them, okay, it's not going to help. I realize that. But damage control. Don't throw into the aggravated situation more than has to be there. Okay? And it's an important attitude that Bali Tshuva have to be taught, okay? That in becoming frum, the notion that like Echad Nishkemana, Echad Nishkentata is not true, okay? It's not true. And if you ask anybody, in other words, the musik that I don't have to have Akara Sattai because they're not frum and I'm frum, I've heard these kinds of things, okay? It's not Eiskalten. It's absolutely not Eiskalten. Yeah, like Sasayev Adami and like Sasayev Mitzri. Why? Because Kiger HaYisav Arzi. We were 210 years Avadim in Mitzrayim, and we're not allowed to be Messiah of the Mitzri because of it. So what are you going to turn to your parents? Because they weren't from and you became from. So they're like, they're worse than a Mitzri. There's an anger from Mitzrayim. It's not. It's from. That, this is a classical example of from. You'll excuse me, but it is. It's an example of a krumkite. That's not really an expression of... Now, there are certain things that I might have gotten from my parents that are counterproductive to my Yiddishkeit. Okay, so those things, you don't have to spell everything out to your parents about what they did to you that's counterproductive. But the things that are productive, you can be makatayv those things and you can appreciate those things and you can give them a sense that you feel that you built on certain things that they gave you, as opposed to just saying, like, I didn't get anything valuable in my life until the day I met my Rebbe. You know? It's very emotional, but it's not fear and it's not true. All right, let's get to the difficult situation of a couple. Okay? One from, one not from. Okay? So, really this divides itself into two parts. Okay? Before marriage and after marriage. Okay? Before marriage, two people come to you, and one is clearly, you know, in the Baal Tshuva process, and the other one is clearly uninterested. Okay? And they come to you, and they want advice. Can it work? Can't it work? Okay? You tell them, the Ruchel Bitva Haktana, find yourselves somebody else. Okay? In other words, before marriage, where one is not interested, and one is already in process, okay? And, you know, it won't be a problem, we'll handle it, we'll this, we'll that, okay? If anybody would take statistics on this, okay, you don't statistically get involved in a marriage that 9 out of 10 times doesn't work, or 8 out of 10 times doesn't work. Just improbabilities. I mean, would you go out with somebody and decide to marry them if you know statistically that 8 out of 10 of these marriages, or even 7 out of 10, okay, would you marry such a person? So like if you're totally immature and, you know, like you fell head over heels for the person, so then you can't talk to the guy anyway, or you can't talk to the girl anyway. But if they are asking, okay, you have to tell them very bluntly, you're coming from two different places, okay? Religion is a separator, okay, when you're in two different places, and no bones about it, okay? Now, one second. Now, there is a different scenario. There's a scenario where one is in the Baal Tshuva process, and the other person is interested in it, has a certain level of interest, might have even made a certain small step of an interest in that direction. That's where the pool becomes a much more difficult one. In other words, two people that are developing in terms of their frumkeit do not have to be in the same place. But there has to be a certain sense of probability that they're both in upward motion. In other words, so if one is already keeping Shabbos and kashrus, okay, and the other one is sincerely interested in trying to understand what it is, and might eat, and is prepared to keep it provisionally until they learn what it is, not to take it away from the one that's already acquired it, yeah, and all other elements in the shidduch are good, you know, there's good chemistry, there's this, there's that, they're sensitive, they're mentioned, you know, all other factors being equal, okay, so then you wouldn't necessarily say a no. When I said the unequivocal no is where you see clearly that the two people have different minds, okay? And if they have different minds, okay, you have to do everything in your power to discourage it, okay? Now sometimes people have this ridiculous notion in their head, oh, I'll become the kiruv worker for my wife or for my husband. Itaka has no interest, but it's a horrendous gamble. It's a horrendous gamble, and the gamble very often does not work. It does very often doesn't work. So if you're in a situation where you're considering marrying this person, okay, it's a different story once you're married to the person. That's a different business, and you're talking about splitting a relationship that has already developed. That's a whole different ballgame. But going into a relationship, okay, that is, you're dealing with such iffy situations. You have to measure it out. And if one is interested and one is absolutely not interested, forget it. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. And if they come to you and they're getting married under the basis of that it could work, you have an obligation to tell them that you're getting yourself into such challenges and such struggles that it's very questionable if it'll work, if it won't work. Okay? Now,
with a little bit of interest, like you're still putting yourself out on a limb.
No. Yeah, you are. It's a very, very difficult call. What I usually tell people, okay, is that there's levels in interest. I would usually tell a person, find out if the person's level of interest, is he prepared to start doing something? Is he prepared to come to a class? Is he prepared to learn? In other words, the fact that a person says, oh, you know, it's pretty interesting. I'm not talking about that level of interest. Let's make garnish, you know? You know, the Secretary of State can say something in Yiddishkeit is interesting. He'll never do anything about it. I don't mean, oh, it's interesting. That's fascinating. You know, sometimes they tell you that, oh, that's fascinating. I'm talking about where the person is prepared to translate it, if not into Lamaisa, but at least into Lilmot. And then you have to make a judgment in terms of, is the person mature?
Is
he a man?
Is there asking if they should get married?
Yeah. In other words, they know that religion is a problem, and they want to hear. Very often when they come, it's very often too late. In other words, they're so tied to each other that they're coming more for a rubber stamp of approval as to hear, you disappear. You know, that's most. So if you want to know what they're coming for an approval for a real fear that they have. But
even to give that approval,
you can't. You can't give that approval unless you have
some
kind of
class.
No, see,
you're thinking that after their marriage.
Okay, see, you have to. It's not just if he's going to come to a class and not come to a class. You really have to get a sense of who the two individuals are, what their character is, how they relate to each other, their level of maturity. There are a whole bunch of things because at best, it's going to be very challenging. So if you're dealing with two mature people and caring people and people that could respect each other with their differences, Okay? So then there are the qualities that will be able to survive the struggles. But so it's not just, is he willing to come to a class? You really have to get a sense of knowing who these two people are and how committed they are to making it work. I'll give you a marshal. Let me put it to you this way. In our times today, there aren't a whole lot of people coming from secular society that are willing to put in so much work into making a relationship work. Relationships have to be experienced, they have to happen, and the minute there has to be an extra amount of work going into it, okay, an extra amount, then most people are not ready for the work that's involved. And that's why this is almost like a mute point. But from time to time, you will find people, especially people that are a little bit older when they can get married to each other, that they are mature. Let me give you another marshal.
You can tell them that they have to be prepared for that.
100%. Let me give you a marshal.
You're not thinking on your neck.
Yeah. No, you never do that in Kiruv. You never make a decision for a person in Kiruv. You show them the pros, you show them the cons. You can magnify and amplify one more than the other because you want to hear them to hear it loud and clear. But I always end off, but listen, the decision is yours. Okay? In things that are swing so much back and forth, okay, like that, you know, those kinds of things, the derech klal, what you try to do, but klal, when people come to you for eitzes in general, when people come for eitzes, okay, it's always kedai in giving an eitzah, when you put in the position of giving an eitzah, of helping the person think together with you. Okay? And then, do you know what I'm saying? Another said he should hear the pros and he should hear what are the goods, what are the positives, what are the negatives. And work with the person. In other words, not that he's presenting it to you and that he's sitting like a dumb log and you know and you're going through it your own. Involve him in the process. Okay? Involve him in the process. Right? Let me give you a marshal. Difference of opinion of how we look at something. Okay, so that it automatically, in other words, how far the disagreement can go has no boundaries. Okay, it has no boundaries. Okay, now, and then there are couples that are mature enough to know that there can be differences, and it's not to say that the differences have to be resolved and so on and so forth, but that they don't allow, or they make conscious efforts not to allow whatever those differences are to go beyond the goal and to, so to speak, start demolishing the relationship. Let me give you a marshal. Let's say two people are arguing about whatever they're arguing about, and I'm so upset that you think like this and you don't think like me that now I begin showing disrespect for you because I'm so upset with the way you think about this and you don't think like me. Okay, that's already taking a difference of opinion that doesn't necessarily have to, so to speak, destroy the whole relationship, and you know it's all out war, you know. And in other words, there's above the belt and below the belt when people fight. Okay? Now, there are some couples that understand that there can be differences and there could be sharp differences, okay? But I'm not going to allow it to go beyond this point. Okay? And then, what? No. So for that, you go to a rug, you go to a marriage counselor, they're different things. Those things need to be dealt with. I'm not saying that. But there is an apparatus in some people that once there's a sharp difference, there is nothing that is not safe from being attacked. Do you know what I'm saying? The person, the personality, the relationship.
It was very deep.
What?
It was very deep.
Yeah. It's a tipus. It's a kind of person. Okay? And then there are other people that have the ability to separate. Now, when a couple comes to you and one of them has become from and the other one's not, and they don't have an ability to separate, forget it. Okay? There isn't a way that this is going to survive. On the other hand, if they could separate issues, okay, which means that even though we have totally different perspectives on life, each of us will have a respect for the other person. Okay? So then there's a hope, okay, that somewhere down the line the thing can possibly work. Okay? One of the common mistakes that happens, okay, between one person that becomes from the other one that's not interested in becoming from, is that the first thing that goes out the window is respect.
Yeah? The one that becomes from doesn't respect the one that's not from because he's a Russian, he's a this, and he's like, whatever else you want. And the one that's not from doesn't respect the one that became from is because he's off the wall. He's fallen off the deep end. As Gevurah and Froth. So, if what's going on between them is like unbridled disrespect for each other, okay, then it's only a matter of time before it's going to fall apart. If there's no respect, there's no relationship. You get it?
Right?
I'm saying, but I'm saying, one second, I'm saying, but the background that anything should ever come to be, okay, there has to be mutual respect. Now, mutual respect also means something else. There's another part to it. Another part. Are we both on a campaign to change the other person? Okay? Now, this is also a very common mistake. Okay? People go into relationships and they're on campaigns. I am determined to change you. Okay? Either the from one, the non-from one, or vice versa. Okay? Now, if you're on a campaign to actively change the other person, and the other person knows it and feels it, the relationship's not going to work either. Why? Because if you're on an active campaign, I must change you, the other person, you know how it's defined by the other person? I am not adequate. Period. I'm not adequate. In other words, I'm not what I need to be for the other person. Okay? That also is a major destroyer of a relationship. Now, so how will the relationship ever get any place? So mutual respect is one thing. Don't be on campaigns. And the only other thing that I could suggest is do your own thing, so to speak. I'm talking about the one that's from in the relationship. And try to cultivate, okay, in pleasant ways. And by being an example yourself, okay, and being an example yourself, okay, to the other person, so that the person might be able to see it. You know, very often people that are not from and that the other one becomes from on them, they suffer from a lot of stereotypic pictures of what orthodoxy is all about. It's one of the major problems. If you can present a picture that is not the stereotypic picture that the other person believes orthodoxy is all about, that will allay the person's fears. They'll look at it, okay? If you're a mensch, instead of becoming a vengeful person under the flag of religion, okay, so then there is a hope that the person will come and look and take a taste. It's a long process. Boy, do you have to have patience. If the people that come to you, if you see that one of the two of them has no patience, okay, or has this like you belong to me kind of thing, you're my property and you do as I tell you to do kind of thing, forget it. Those kinds of you know, any of those things being present in a relationship, okay, are busters in a relationship. So it's a very unique kind of a situation, okay, that in which these things will work, okay, in which these things will work. Encouraging a person, I'll give you another marshal, okay. I have now a case between a couple where the guy became frum, and the woman is absolutely uninterested, almost anti-religious, okay? They have a kid, right? They have a child. It's a whole story how they have the child, don't ask. But, and the way that he came to Yiddishkeit was primarily emotionally. In other words, it just felt right, okay? In other words, when he came from like a semi-traditional home, but I guess, you know, just in his sensitivity, it just didn't feel right not to keep Shabbos. There are such tikkunim around, yeah? And, like, his coming to Yiddishkeit wasn't like through an intellectual quest and this and that. He was just looking for, in other words, life wasn't, you know, it wasn't put together. He knew there was something very wrong. He started doing this, that, and the other thing, and things seemed to feel much, much better for him. That's how he came to his Yiddishkeit. Okay. What?
Rare.
It is. It's an unusual situation. But he's at that. You know, he's in general. He relates very emotionally and this and that. It's not to say that he's not an intelligent person, but that's how he came to it. Okay. Now he expected that his wife should come to it the same way. Okay. Now that's ridiculous. No two people are the same, and no two people have the same process. So. What I told them, okay, I don't know if it'll ever work, believe me, I don't know.
in that case, because there are other elements there. But I told them, okay, I told him, you have to give her the freedom of trying and approaching Yiddishkeit, okay, her way, not your way. In other words, I told them a simple thing. I tried to encourage her, listen, you're married to the guy. You like the guy, okay? Everything else in the relationship is seemingly right. There's a kid between the two of you, right? Right? Before you, so to speak, blow up this relationship because you don't want to be religious, why don't you at least give a look at what Judaism is? Go to a series of classes. See if you can get a better understanding of what it is that your husband is observing, for whatever reason he's observing, but that you can have an understanding from where you are what he's doing and why he's doing what he's doing. In other words, I told her basically that you owe it as a wife and as a mother to at least give that a try and don't prejudge it. She was macabre, okay? She was macabre, she accepted it. And there are other aggravating situations over there because, like, he threw the whole thing on her and forced the whole thing on her. So today, she's very anti it because of the way that he brought it on her. Okay? So that's a different problem, you know. An insulted woman and a hurt woman is a much more difficult... What? You know, it's a whole different ballgame. You know, you're dealing with an unknown quantity of difficulty once you get into that ballpark. And, you know, okay, for what it, you know, why he did it and this and that is unimportant, but it's a fact. And that's a problem in this particular situation. But I'm hoping that she'll go. The very fact that she'll go, okay, is a statement of an openness, okay, that she'll listen, she'll hear, she'll at least come to appreciate what he's doing, even if she's not totally prepared. But once there could be a little bit of an appreciation, I understand where you're coming from kind of thing, okay, at least there'll be more of a respect in the relationship. And you never know if down the line, okay, she won't, because she does have the ability to be dedicated and to do things, you know, as a good wife. She has that quality. She's not like just a half-gazit person. She does, when she sees that it's absolutely the ratzon of her ba'al, she has like an element of ishak sheira in her. She has it. So I feel that there is a basis for it. But the first step over here is I'm trying to push very hard that she has to give a more intelligent look at it, if for no other reason that she's married and it might help her understand her husband better and therefore help the relationship survive. And she's prepared to do it. It's a step. Where it will go, I don't know yet, but it's a step.
Just a minor point. Is it tough? I assume it's tough if you disagree with certain couples. I mean, once they're married already, disagreement is healthy to bring out the ultimate resolve. Would that be not major disagreements?
I mean, you don't have to get into a fight, but...
I'm saying, is that true?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's unusual. It's unusual to find a couple, okay, that are married and are happily married on a very deep level that never had differences of opinions that they had to work out. It's unusual. I'm not saying it never happens, but it's unusual. Very often, closeness requires people really presenting what they are, making themselves vulnerable to differences of opinion, and then learning the ways of, in spite of it all, coming to understand each other, respect each other, and so on and so forth. So it's definitely true that very often after a bang-up fight, okay, two people can come closer to each other. It's very true. You know, a couple that's very cordial and you never say, you know, most often those relationships are not a deep relationship. Hi.
If she would have said to you that being he hasn't shown you, he tried to force his way on her because he hasn't shown respect to her way of life, why should I, speaking in for her, why should I now try to learn what Yiddishkeit is about to respect him?
Okay, so let's make something clear, okay? What a person does, okay, that doesn't affect another person, okay, that doesn't affect another person, but they're doing it because it's meaningful to them, is not a display of disrespect to the other person. Right? It only becomes disrespectful if what I'm doing, it's not enough that I'm doing it, but you need to do it. You like it or not, I'm making you do it. That's when it becomes an issue of disrespect. The fact that I do something, Okay? Okay? For myself. That itself is not an issue of disrespect. Okay. Give me a few minutes. Well, daven 10 o'clock, what is this story? Okay. So give me a few minutes because I really wanted to do this. Okay? Major subjects in Sfarim. Okay? It's short. It's a short amount of time to do it. But let's go through it a little bit. I brought with me, okay, I brought with me just for the sake of making it a little bit more efficient. I brought my most recent tape list. Okay, now this is not a sales pitch because most of this you can get through the Torah Tape Library. That's not the point of it. But it's most of, if not all of the subjects that you would ever have to run into in Kiruv work, all in one booklet. Okay, but what I've done is I reviewed it. Okay, in preparation for tonight's class. And I'd like to circle, in other words, once you have these copies in front of you, just circle, okay, certain major subjects, okay, in different areas, you know, and the Svarim and the Makairis, where you would be able to do more work in those areas, okay? So that's the Kavanah. So if you could just, you know, just give out a copy, and then I'll go through it quickly. These copies, in other words, these copies are for you. You can mark them up, you can take them, whatever you want to do with them. Most of them are in the Torah Tape Library, so if you ever have an interest in listening to any of them, you can just get them over there. Most of them are there. Okay, now the first on the list over here, okay, it's Jewish Thought Series, which in plain Hebrew, in plain Russian, HaKadosh is Hashkafa. I realized that it spells out in abbreviations JTS, which is itself a difficult, that's why it's not JTS, it's only JT on the side in the order form. But obviously when you're dealing with people that are totally raw, okay, and you have to deal with basic Hashkafa issues. As a first step, okay. So now I have underlined over here like this. The first subject over here is free will. Okay, it's a major subject that you need to understand. Absolutely need to understand. The person's freedom to choose and not to choose. There are lots of people out there that believe that past a certain point they can't choose, they can't make changes, etc., etc. They need to understand the subject. Okay. The best place for you to look to get a pretty good depth in the subject is the Michtam Eliyahu. Okay? What? Yeah. The Kudas HaBchira, and then in Chelek Beis or Chelek Gimel, he has another part on Bechira She'icha V'Hana. Okay? It's underlined later. We'll go through the list. Okay? That is most probably the best entrance into it. Now, this is not to say that you're not going to find certain things in the Rambam Hilchos Tshuva. In Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam talks a lot about Bechira in the Chavos HaVavos. You're going to find in Shaar Avodas Elokim and in Shaar HaBitachon major discussions about Bechira, but so to speak, the shortcut, the cliff notes on the subject of Bechira, like a good is Michtam Eliyahu. Okay. Now the second thing over here is the relevant definitions of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means how do we relate to Hashem? Do we understand Him? Don't we understand Him? Can we define Him? Can't we define Him? Right. This is largely a philosophical issue. Okay, you will run into a lot of people that will ask you questions like, how do you worship something that you don't understand, and what do you understand, and what don't you understand? It is a subject that you're going to have to deal with, okay, with a more intelligent person, okay? And the best address for this is the Nefesh HaChaim, okay? And you would be looking in the Nefesh HaChaim, you would be primarily looking in Shaar Aleph and Shaar Gimel. Okay? Now, parenthetically, Shaar Aleph and Shaar Beis, okay, towards the end of each Shaar, okay, or Shaar Beis and Shaar Gimel, I think Shaar Beis and Shaar Gimel, excuse me, there are major discussions there of the whole process of tshuva. How does the process of tshuva work? Like all of the different parts of the neshama, and what gets destroyed by an aveira, and how does a person come back? Fascinating discussions of how it works. Okay, it's the last problem in Shaar, not Shaar Beis, it's Shaar Aleph and Shaar Gimel.
okay? Towards the end of Shar Aleph, and then also again towards the end of Shar Gimel. Okay? You'll find it. I mean, yeah, anybody can give me a buzz. I don't have the Nefesh Chaim in front of me. But that's just Derech Agav. But in Shar Aleph and Gimel, he also talks about the two ways of relating to Hashem. Okay? And the Michtam Eliyot elaborates in Chela Gimel on all of those things of the Nefesh Chaim in Shar Gimel. Okay? On how to define HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, the next thing, we're going down to 5 and 6. Tzadik V'Aloi. Okay? The suffering of the innocent, undeserved punishment. It comes up later on your next sheet, on page 3, why the innocent suffer, 115 through 122. Like, that's a whole series that just deals with Tzadik V'Aloi. Okay? The two basic, that's absolutely something that you have to go through. Because most people that you will confront, sooner or later, whatever you try to accomplish with them, they're going, but what's about the Holocaust, and what's about this person suffering? It's an unavoidable question, okay? The major address for this subject is the Chayvus Halvav Shar HaBitachon, okay? Is Chayvus Halvav Shar HaBitachon. Derech Agav, I can say in a very general way, okay, that if you become involved in Kiruv, on any, you know, level of hashkafa, okay, whatever you do with the rest of the Chayvus Halvav Shar HaBitachon, you have to know. Okay? Just to be able to answer these kinds of questions and a myriad of other questions that have to do with what's human responsibility and what's Hashem, you know, Bechira and Hashgacha Pratis and all of that, at least the Shar HaBitachon you have to know. Okay? I know it's logical, it's persuasive, it's not terribly difficult, and it has almost all of the yesodis that you need, okay, in the dealing between Bechir and Hashgacha Pratis. Right? In addition to the Shar HaBitachon in terms of Tzadik V'Aloi, there's also, in the Derech Hashem, okay, there are a few prakim on Hashgacha Klalis and Hashgacha Ishis. That's how the Ramchal refers to it.
This is for
Tzadik V'Aloi and Rosh HaVetayvla. Chayvus Halvav Shar HaBitachon and Derech Hashem. Hashgacha Klalis and Hashgacha Ishis. There are two, three prakim there. Within those prakim, he gives many of the reasons for Tzadik V'Aloi and Rosh HaVetayvla. Okay? Between the two, you'll have plenty. Okay, going down now. Now, in this list, this is a shtickle unprofessional, okay? But within this list, okay, of 140 tapes, there are about 1920 tapes that are dedicated to the Yud Gimel Ikrim of the Rambam. Okay? Now, the way that I deal with the Yud Gimel Ikrim of the Rambam, okay, is not philosophically to prove them. In other words, I explained some of the logic behind it, but not the Torah's effort, not the Torah's proof. But what I do with them is I show how each one of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, how it is a practical philosophy. In other words, how it works day to day, how it chaps a nafgamina day to day. A person has to know the Yud Gimel Ikrim. And where are the roots of the Yud Gimel Ikrim? Where you have to look for that, you have to look in the Perek Yuvav, Zayin Ches, Tes, Yud, Society HaTayra, and you have to know the Rambam's Hakdama to the last Perek in Sanhedrin, the Chelek, where the Rambam shtels avek the Yud Gimel Ikrim in the Perish of Mishnayos. Okay? Now, I could give you the list of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, okay, if you want, because here it's completely Shaloi Ala Seda. But I'll just give you numbers. If you want to just jot down the numbers, okay? The numbers would be like this, more or less in order, okay? More or less in order of the Ikrim. 120, JT, 1, hang a minute, let me just find it here. Yeah. JT 128 is the first Ikka. 123 and 124 is the second Ikka. 123 and 124 is the second Iker of Achdus. The third Iker is JT 140, Ein Eguf, Vela Yesigei or Masigei Haguf. Okay?
Which one was that?
140. Is Ein Eguf, Vela Yesigei or Masigei Haguf. Number four is Kadmain. Okay? I recently dealt with the fourth Iker much more extensively, but I didn't dedicate a tape to Kadmain. But it is discussed together with the second Iker, and with 123 and 124. But there isn't yet a separate tape on that fourth Iker of Kadmain. Then you have
The next ikar is direct avoda, 131. Then you have nevuah, which is 132, 133, 134, 135. It literally goes through Parag Zion, Tes, Tes, and Yud of Hilchos Yisari HaTorah. Okay? And that's really Ikavav and Zion. The Vuas Moshe is Ikav Zion. Then you have the divine authorship of Torah. You absolutely need to know it. And the Makairis. Okay? The in the tapes, it's JT 40 and 75. Okay? 40 and 75. One is the divine authorship of Torah. The other is what? The rabbinic legislation. Like, where was the Kaya Chachamim to be Mechadish in Torah? Okay? If you want to learn it properly, not just a summary from a tape, you have to learn the Rambam's Hakdama to Perish HaMishnayis in Zroel. Okay? Now, parenthetically, you don't have to do this all at once. It's just, it's a list of things that slowly to accumulate a knowledge of these things.
The
tapes quote Mikairis. Yeah, they quote Mikairis. What? No, it's not such a bad list. We're almost finished here. We're up to the eighth Yusayid. Okay, the ninth Yusayid has to do with
seven
is Nevuas Moshe. It's part of 131, 132. The eighth is the eighth divine authorship of Torah, Torah Min HaShemayim. It also rabbinic legislation, right? That encompasses the Ikar HaChess. Then Ikar HaTes is that Shaloi Tishtana HaTayra. I put it together with the Nevuah tape, so it's already there. Then the Ikar HaYud is that the Eivishter is a Yedeya. Okay? That's on tape 129, intimate knowledge of all things. Okay? The 11th is Schar V'Einish, which is JT 118. It's part of the Tzadik Barale series. Scharba Einish. And then the twelfth is Mashiach. Okay. Where is that on the list here? Yeah, facing the truth about Mashiach. That's an interesting thing. Okay. You can imagine what's on the tape. Well, that's 130. No, I'm pretty respectful. What? I left all over. And Tchias HaMesim is 31, JT 31 and 32. That's Yud Gimel. Eker Yud Gimel.
So the Nevuah is on which? 9.
Nine is together with 131, 132, 133. I put it all together.
5 and 6 overlap with 13.
What?
5 and 6 overlap with
13.
No,
13
is 31 and 32.
Oh, 13 is 31, not
132. 31 and 32. That's Tchias HaMesim. Okay, now, so let's go through some, let's just do one or two more topics very quickly. Chosen people, understanding the hashkafa of Am Nivchar, a major problem. Am Nivchar, where is it in the tapes? A minute. There are two tapes, one chosen people versus intermarriage, but there's one that comes before, 50, JT 50. Yeah. Parenthetically, if you want to avoid the tape and just go to the Makar, the Derech Hashem has a whole perek on the Yisayid of Am Nivcha. Okay? And most of the material in that tape comes from the Derech Hashem. Let's go through. It's not shy to go through everything. Okay? You can look at the lists and you can ask me about it. I mean, there's a phone number there. I try to sometimes get back to people. But there's certain svarim that it's kedai to get a yediyah in. I mentioned already the Chayav Salva v'Shar Bitachin. Certainly, like the first half or so of the Derech Hashem is very valuable. The Michtam Eliyahu, primarily the things that have to do with Bechir and Hashgaf and Chelik Aleph and Chelik Gimel. Chelik Beis is Chumash. It's all a different parasha. That's not really the place where to start. But Chelik Aleph, Chelik Gimel, you'll see, just by looking through the table of contents, you'll see many of the hashkafic things even that I've mentioned now. Okay. it's a good sefer. It's an easy way of getting a good movement because he's a combination of Derech Hashem and Morale and Rambam and this and that. I mean, in Edison, okay, I told the Bachram that if you'd ask me, put away the missiles, show, you know, I'm supposed to be encouraging them to learn Musa. But I tell them, put away the missiles, Sharon, you'll get to it in a couple of years. Put away the even the Rabbi Nigaina, except during Elul. Start with Hashkafa. Start with Nechon Eliyahu. Start with a certain amount of Derech Hashem. Start with... Why? Because once the Hashkafa is there, so then the Musa will follow the Mela. But Musa, without a foundation in Hashkafa, doesn't have a foundation. It doesn't have
the first practice of Hashem is Hashkafa.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, but I'm just saying, like, in a general way. And why am I saying this statement? I'm saying this statement that people that are involved in Kirov sometimes make a mistake. Okay, that the best thing to learn with somebody who's trying to be Makarv is a real Musa Sefer. Okay, I feel that it's basically a mistake, if you think like that. Okay, after everything is said and done, Gesunta people don't survive Musa Sefer so well. And they have to be learned very carefully, and that has to be everything has to be suga passed, you know. So the notion that I'll learn Mesil Sisharim, you know, or some real, you know, Rabbi Yisrael, you know, with somebody coming in, it's dangerous business. Okay, certainly the hastala with the person has to be hashkafadik. It has to. You could even if you're so inclined. I mean, there's svarim that are sifrei chassidus. But that they give a certain hashkafa and a certain encouragement to a person at the beginning of the process. So, you know, svarim like Svasemes and Shemeshvul, these kinds of svarim. Now, obviously, you're not going to learn them cover to cover, but if you have a chance, arayin to cook it, and you're looking for a vart to say, you know, by a Shabbos or something like that, you need a vart that's relevant, you need a vart that has some kind of chizuk in it. Those are the two major qualities in anything that you say. You're going to find that most of your work, if you do it well in Kirov work, is you learn a million things and find five things amongst the million that are negated of people that you're talking to. Okay? It has to be things that they could touch up to be relevant to them. Don't say a shena shtickle, a polish shtickle tire was hatachak, you know, azayu. That's meaningless to them. It's meaningless. I mean, for Yechavrus and Yeshiva, it's fine. But for him, it's meaningless. It has to be something that he walks away and he says, das chavt anach gemina. I feel that I can look at something differently because of it. Okay, it has to be relevant, okay? And by and large, it has to have an element of chizuk in it. It has to be that. Now, I'm not saying you can sometimes look in a sefer like the Alta Kinkelim or something like that, which is pretty hardcore Musa, there's no question about it. But you can find, as you go through it, okay, you can find things that are very insightful, very relevant, and even dvarim shel chizuk, okay, in it. It's a tremendous selection process that you have to go through. But the most important thing is it must be relevant. Okay, it must be relevant. The second most important thing is there has to be an element of chizuk in it. Because, in other words, it's just like you have to give somebody medicine. It says, even if it makes sense. So if there's a certain amount of chizuk that comes with it, so then it's it'll be much more a davar haniskabel. We have to stop them.
We hope you've enjoyed the share. We also have 900 other shiurim available for download. We are interested in getting the word out. If you know of other media outlets or any other advertising ideas, please call us at 718-407-0865 or email us at info@rabbikirzner.org. That's info@rabbikirzner.org. Thank you.